Good afternoon, everyone. Today is August 30th, 2025. Welcome to the teleseminar. I already have one of the candidates on the line. I'm going to go straight to her. Anonymous. Anonymous, are you on the line?
Yes, I'm on the line.
All right. If you want to present your case.
So I have a 26-year-old nulla gravida who presented to me after a consultation with my colleague who performed a colposcopy. The indication for her, she had an ascus HPV positive 16 on her pap smear noted at her well woman exam. She then had a colposcopy done by my partner, which had noted CAN2 with the colposcopy. Based on the report that she had and also interviewing my colleague, it was a sufficient colposcopy performed. No ECC was collected at the time, but cervical biopsy showed CIM2. We then counseled the patient.
So can I interject here? You said it was a sufficient colposcopy? What do you mean by that?
Meaning by that, she had documented that she was able to see the squamous columnar junction. She was able to have full visualization of the cervix, as well as all the surrounding tissue and the vaginal mucosa. And she was able to see the white changes that had been noted to be positive for CAN2 when they were noting as a pathology.
Okay, continue.
And so afterwards, the patient had been offered initially by my partner interval colposcopies at 6 and 12 intervals versus excisional procedure. For some reason, the patient had opted to have a second opinion with another provider. I think because of, I guess, the discomfort she had exposed me with the colposcopy, she simply wanted to just pursue excision because she really could not tolerate colposcopies and was not a fan of the surveillance. She was counseled on the risk related to that, especially when it comes to considerations for childbearing, and had opted for a treatment procedure with excision with a week. So we had performed the week procedure with colposcopy. And the pathology coming back from that had actually not identified CAN2, but had noted changes as per the pathology, changes consistent with colposcopy and HPV, but they actually did not note dysplasia with the specimen. And after that was within a departmental review with pathology, and we also reconsulted them again to kind of clarify the language as far as what they're describing in the report. After which the patient agreed with the plan for an interval pap within 6 months.
I'm sorry, you're breaking up. Can you speak deeper into the phone? Because I can't hear what you just said.
The patient had agreed to the plan for an interval pap smear within 6 months following the leak procedure.
Now, why did you bring this question to the floor? What was your concern?
I kind of had the same a question as far as, you know, my expectation of doing the leap was that I would find at least one or two with the tissue that was excised, but they actually had not described the tissue to have either of those changes, despite what was identified with the colposcopy. And so the inconsistencies are kind of the questions that we had, just given, you know, the sampling that we had prior to the treatment, and then the treatment was performed, what was actually identified.
So what you presented to the office, so for everybody that's on the call, it says leap specimen benign with focal reactive stromal changes suggestive of prior colposcopy biopsy.
Correct.
So is that really inconsistent?
So the one inconsistency is just noting CIN2 or any dysplasia that is specific. I worked with pathology before, and they generally are actually very clear on noting CN1, 2, or 3 when they do examine the specimens, although there are different pathologists. But this language, when we asked them to clarify, we had asked specifically, do you see any CN1, 2, or 3? They said they do not, but they see that there's changes consistent with the colposcopy, which is a little confusing, just because of this language we use initially.
So your concern is that you left CIN
scan to on the server.
Now, what if you flip it to the other side? What if the colposcopy was so good she had a small area of CIN 2 or 3? You biopsied
that
it, and then it jump-started the body to heal itself.
That would be the best-case scenario for the patient, which we hope to reaffirm again when we do the interval tap. But that would be
now,
the best scenario.
Because you definitely, I mean, because the issue here is when we do a leap or an excisional procedure that's a cone, what are you really doing? What is the point of that procedure?
I mean, you're hoping to, you know, superficially excise the tissue that has the dysplasia with the hope that the remaining tissue of the patient is disease-free.
That's correct, but unfortunately, you are going to be taking tissue because you're literally taking, do you do your leap with any Lugols? Do you do it under colposcopy to ensure that you got
the
full transformation?
I utilize the Lugol solution.
Mm-hmm. So you could see from that you're getting the entire transformation zone and anything that is, you know, of issue, any lesions, correct?
That's correct.
Right, but while you're doing that, you're removing normal tissue too.
That is also true.
It's a destructive procedure because we're literally, you know, shaving, however deep you want to go deep, abnormal with normal tissue, and hopefully you go deep enough to get all the abnormal tissue, correct?
That's correct.
Yeah. So, I mean, I personally don't tell a patient, there's always a possibility the pathology will be negative. But it happens on many occasions. I'm sure everybody here on the line can attest that there's a patient, they have CIN 2 to 3, you take them to the operating room or to your procedure room in your office to do the leap, and the pathology comes back, you know, reactive changes, completely negative. So I really don't see anything wrong with it. Now, if you had, I'm making this up, 5 leaps on your case list and they all had negative pathology, then I'm questioning it.
Okay.
Am I making sense? So I guess one question they could ask is, well, how deep should the leap be? Any idea on that?
It would go with the depth that's successful with the cautery device that I'm using. So the device that I'm using typically has a depth of about a little over 2 centimeters.
So you're saying that the leap that you performed is more than 2 centimeters?
That would be the greatest depth that we can access. And reviewing the specimen, that is...
Now, did you do that in this case?
That's actually the measurement of the specimen that they had documented with pathology when they received it as well.
So you took an entire two centimeters. So
at its greatest depth.
20 millimeters. Do you think that's appropriate? Is that a little too much? Now, they didn't do an ECC, correct?
An ECC was also performed.
It was performed?
Correct.
Okay, because I had heard it was not performed, and that came back negative, correct? I'm talking about for the colposcopy.
I'm sorry. For the colposcopy, it was not performed, but for the leap, we did perform an ECC after we exposed.
So let me flip things around a little bit. So you said initially that she was scared of getting colposcopies. So with shared decision making, she elected to proceed with the most invasive of the options, even though she was an oviparous patient. I'm assuming she wanted future childbearing, and I'm assuming she understood. So explain to me how you would counsel a patient in regards to this scenario, in regards to her options.
So for the patients that are oviparous, for all patients, we do let them know the risks related to preterm labor with the excision of the cervix. That risk is noted both with the colonic colon as well as with the leap procedure, and that's attributed to having a shorted cervix. So they are counseled that does come with excisional procedure, which is why they do have the alternative option of interval colposcopy. Because the patient was intolerant of the initial, she was really intolerant of her initial colposcopy. She was adamant against any interval colposcopies. Also knowing that in the event that she does have a successful excision, if we do have a recurrence of HPV, she still may have future colposcopies. She still wanted to undergo the excisional procedure. And generally speaking, I tend to try to offer the cold knife cone for this patient population, especially those who, you know, when I perform colposcopies, I usually do perform an ECC. But especially those with negative ECCs, I would prefer to blend them with the lead. Knowing what my techniques are, I tend to take less of the cervix with the lead excision compared to my technique with the cold knife cone.
I'm sorry, you're breaking up, or you're not far away from the phone. Discuss again what you're saying about if you had a negative ECC, what you do with your patients, because I couldn't hear that.
Yeah, so typically the patients who I am performing colposcopy, they will get ECCs, especially if they are the melliferous patients with negative ECCs. I generally would offer them a leap over a cold knife cone in those scenarios. And the rationale for that is that my technique, I'm more likely to have a shorter excision with the leap compared to how much I'm excising with my cold knife cone. Just with my surgical approach, it tends to take less tissue when I'm doing leaps compared to the cold knife cones.
So when you say your surgical approach, what do you do differently if you're going to take less of a leap specimen?
Looking at the patient's cervix, I tend to use the shorter electrodes that are available. Typically, they're kind of in the shape of a sail. So we just do a simple rotation that's able to have a cold.
So you do like an apple core?
That's correct.
And
that's what the excision that we're doing. So I don't do the loop-shaped one and then that rectangular shape. I usually don't do two separate passes, but just one simple apple core. So when you're measuring those devices, a lot of times the greatest depth of those, it tends to have at least about 2 centimeters, even with the smaller electrodes.
But in this case, you had concern because she was melliferous, correct? So did it have to be 2 centimeters? Could have been shorter. The specimen.
It could have been shorter.
What's the I guess you never bring up studies or literature or data on this exam, but is there a set measurement that if you get to that point, you should have gotten all the specimens and have negative margins?
If I go past.
If there like a certain measurement depth of the leap that is sufficient to most likely get any abnormality,
I would say at least a centimeter should be adequate.
7 millimeters?
A centimeter.
A centimeter. Got it. So why'd you do 2 centimeters in this case?
Given the length of the electrode, that's the depth that I had placed in for this patient. She also had a notable cervical canal that was slightly dilated, so it did allow for a decent passage of the electrode to go to the full length of the device.
Because I see a disconnect. So you first presented the case saying, well, I would have preferred monitoring her. But because she was scared of doing the copos, you know, in interval steps through the months, she elects for the leap. And then, well, I'm going to do a 2 centimeter leap. Am I making sense?
Yeah.
So you need to kind of tailor it to, even though I would have preferred, or don't even bring it up, I would have preferred her to have undergone the monitoring. I still took into consideration that I wanted to make sure I got all abnormal tissue. If I'm going to do the leap, I'm going to do it correctly. Am I making sense? So I think you've got to present it in that way because it made it sound like you would have preferred her to be monitored. That being said, when you do your copals in your office, is there an ability to give a patient some type of anxiolytic, analgesia, for her to tolerate better the colposcopy?
We do offer patients Toradol. Not all of our patients have, like, rights to the office. So we don't typically
they
offer...
They don't have a what? I'm sorry? You broke up?
Right. They don't have a person to be with them to mute. So typically we would offer Toradol free procedure to optimize their tolerance.
Okay. Could you have changed your presentation or what you offer to this patient, have somebody bring her, give her an angiolytic, give her a little bit stronger medication to do the colposcopy?
That is one option. I have also have offered patients who are extremely anxious, that are intolerant of any in-office exams. I have offered patients colposcopies under anesthesia, but those patients in general tend to be the exception to the general patient population. But we do
offer.
And
was that offered to the patient?
For this patient, she was probably one of the earlier cases I've had, and I don't believe we had offered her that.
Okay. Because the way you present, I'm just saying how you presented the case. It's like, because she doesn't like doing colposcopies, she's going to do a LEAP. Am I making sense? And then now that you have the result, of course, if it was CIN2, we wouldn't have this conversation, right?
That's correct.
You did the right thing for the patient. But seeing that it wasn't, I think whoever did the colposcopy got the entire small area that was affected. Remember, with the LEAP, you're taking good with bad tissue.
Yeah.
Now, in what type of scenario should you be very aggressive in getting
with
as much tissue out?
CIN3 positive endocervical curettage, usually we would be offering, I would prefer to offer patients a colnect cone with the conversation again of, you know, childbearing adenocarcinoma in situ.
Correct. Now, can you do a LEAP with adenocarcinoma in situ?
I would not suggest that because you really have to optimize identification of your margins, and you can't afford the artifact that will come with the cautery.
Correct. So you should do a cold knife cone in those situations. In regards to depth, it depends who you read. Some say 5 to 8 millimeters. However, I did find, and of course you don't say studies or literature, on the exam, there is an NIH study that is pretty recent from 2021 that said a minimum of 7.2 millimeters should be able to get all the abnormal cells and have hopefully negative margins. So 2 centimeters is a little bit excessive. So there's that disconnect where I would have preferred her, and of course, you know, the pathology, the renal pathology, I would prefer her to have been monitored, but she elected. So I think you need to tailor your presentation a little bit different in the sense of that you gave her all the options. She's aware of the risks. I don't know how you're going to go around saying I did offer her analgesia, somebody driving in, because you got to tailor it to this specific patient because this is on the case list. And then she elected to have this procedure. Am I making sense?
That's correct.
You know what I'm saying? And then to have gotten the 2 centimeter specimen, I think it's a little bit excessive because that's the way I could hear in your voice your concerns about doing the procedure to begin with. Am I making
exactly.
sense?
That's correct.
I mean, I'm assuming the patient's happy.
She is. I mean, she also kind of had a little question as far as what we initially had from COPO and the pathology. So she had the same kind of question as well.
But you did, you know, go through it with the pathology department. They can only do the best they can with the information they have.
Exactly.
Is it possible the first person overread it? The next person underread it. I'm not a pathologist. You're not a pathologist. We have to take it at face value. But the way I see it being presented, it looks like whoever did the colposcopy got the area that was affected. And we really don't present to patients, oh, by the way, after a colposcopy, sometimes it jumpstarts the healing process. So then it goes back to, let's say the excisional procedure had positive margins of CIN2. What would you do in that situation?
In that situation with CIN2, you could consider re-excision. But I would probably offer the patient an interval, at least an interval colposcopy with HPV testing at 6 months, just to reaffirm we're still dealing with the same pathology. And if it is persistent, she can be offered an excision at that time.
But it's possible.
So she could also be counseled again, especially because of the CN2, on reconsidering surveillance, because now we're dealing with even more cervix being removed. So we have a greater incentive for trying to be as concerned as we can.
And it's possible that the process of doing that initial leap jumpstarts the healing process.
Mm-hmm.
Many times I've seen positive margins. You follow them conservatively, very carefully, mm-hmm. and everything's fine. And of course, you do an ECC in those patients.
Okay.
You know? So I think I'd be careful when I do my presentation, because it sounds like, well, she had pain, we're going to take her to the operating room and take out the leak. That's what I felt in my presentation. Did you?
Hello?
Did you feel that in the presentation?
I was hoping to kind of convey conflict in offering excision, but I guess I wasn't that good at doing that.
You know, I mean, in the end, you give the information to the patient that information that you have. I mean, personally, you know, I think also as a patient herself, she couldn't have asked, hey,
mm-hmm.
is there anything you could give me in order to make these procedures easier to deal with? But a lot of times, mm-hmm. some patients, like, just get it out type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You can't really get it out. She wants to get pregnant. And we don't know the long-term effects of doing the leap, of course. Some patients, they get leaps, no problems. Other patients, the patient will say, it wasn't that big of a leap because they told me they weren't going to do a big leap, you know, because I had not mm-hmm. had a baby. And they end up with, you know, the cerclage and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So then that extends to how would you monitor the patient once she gets pregnant? What would you do in that situation?
She should have the standard, which is the interval, the cervical length surveillance, which they would be getting after the first trimester, at least at the first trimester.
And how often would you be doing that?
They should be getting at the first trimester ultrasound. They also should be getting that at least 4 weeks following that, and then also at their anatomy scan, which is between 18 and 20 weeks.
I'm sorry, you're breaking up. Say that again. How often?
They should be getting that at the first trimester ultrasound. They also can consider that at least 4 weeks after that, and then also at their anatomy scan, which is between 18 and 20 weeks.
So you won't be monitoring much more closely? You wouldn't do it every 1 to 2 weeks?
I think 4 weeks would be adequate for these patients.
So you think 4 weeks is adequate? You know, I'm not an expert in any way, shape, or form. I think you got to do it a little bit more frequently, to be honest with you. I am going to open up the call here and see if we have an MFM on the line here. Please keep the background noise at a minimum, okay? So I'm opening everything up for everybody on the call. Is there an MFM on the line? No MFMs? Has anybody had a similar patient? Do people agree you should be monitoring every 4 weeks the cervical length?
I believe that it's with two leaps that you need to be doing cervical length Q2 weeks after 16 weeks up to 24.
So it's after two leaps?
I should still wait.
That's as far as I know in practice. One
like,
leap,
is
I think,
it molded now? Should I
feel
this all away?
And not, required.
This is wet in here.
But two definitely has to do Q2
number
leap.
Two for sure. But I thought there would be nothing wrong. If I was going to do cervical length, I would do it at least every 2 weeks.
I don't
want
to make any of this in the hospital.
I'm going to mute everybody because I hear some background noise. Thank you for putting Anonymous, I'm going to be honest with you. I would look that up. I had not heard.
It
definitely, the more procedures you get, of course, there's going to be an issue.
Mm-hmm.
But I can tell you, I do a lot of case list reviews, and I do see people doing the serial lengths more frequent than every month.
Okay.
You know? And, of course, you know, strict precautions of the patient, because they're usually going to get pelvic pressure. So I can't comment on the length of time. But if you're going to do it, you might as well do it, I think, more than a month. So what you would do it, what, at 12 weeks? You do it at 16 weeks? You could do it at 20 weeks? You know what I'm saying? And then what if something happens at 18 weeks?
Mm-hmm.
You know, worst case scenario, if something happens at 23 weeks, is somebody going to put a surclage at 23 weeks?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Okay.
So does that answer your question? You know, these are just different topics that they can bring up. I didn't think about looking up. But definitely the size of the specimen. And I would just see how often you should be following the patient after she gets pregnant. But I don't think you did anything wrong for the patient. I just would tailor it a little bit different, kind of like it was like, well, she's uncomfortable with the Copal.
Mm-hmm.
Let's do the leap. And I'm thinking that's the way the patient was thinking about it. Get it out, you know. I would not present it as such. You presented it correctly, but just, you know, remove a little bit more of, because that maybe she could have gotten some analgesia or something.
Because
in the end, she didn't really need the leap, right? We didn't know that, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a pretty bread and butter case. You know, if you have so many cases, they may not even notice it.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Very good. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. So I also had a question that was brought in, and it doesn't look like that individual is on the call. So I'm going to read it and then kind of go over it. It's a 19-year-old patient with pelvic pain, noted to have a 15-centimeter ovarian mass. History of right oophorectomy by laparotomy for a 20-centimeter mature teratoma at 15 years of age. Ultrasound shows a 15-centimeter simple appearing left adnexal mass with a soft tissue echogenicity thought to be ovarian tissue or wall nodularity. Her question is, should I have done all tumor markers? She did a laparoscopic cystectomy. The final pathology was benign, mature cystic teratoma. How should she not defend not doing tumor markers? So realistically, I personally, because of the size of the mass, I would have done the tumor markers because what are risk factors for a malignancy in a mature cystic teratoma? So the risk factors are someone who's greater than 45 years of age, a size greater than 10 centimeters, rapid growth, and, you know, malignant type of characteristics noted on imaging, okay? And then what tumor markers would you order, okay? Just as overview. You know, banes of all our existence, the tumor markers for a dysgerminoma, it's an LDH usually. Sometimes HCG could be elevated. Endodermal sinus tumor is AFP. Choriocarcinoma, HCG. With an immature teratoma, it's AFP, LDH, even a CA125, but you may have them negative in the teratoma. And in the embryonal cancers, HCG and AFP. Now, with a size that big, there is a possibility that a mass that big could be a teratoma and it could be kind of have borderline characteristics. So a question that would have been great to have asked the candidate if she was on the line would be like, what did you do during the procedure? Did you do pelvic washings? Did you do a thorough inspection of the entire abdominal cavity? See any evidence of any metastasis anywhere? And even with mass that big, I would send the pelvic washings regardless if the pathology had come back or you did a frozen section that was negative. I'm assuming they did not do a frozen section. But, you know, let's be honest. It has to be difficult to really assess if a 15-centimeter mass is truly benign. And also another question I would like to ask the candidate they did a laparoscopic cystectomy. So how did they do a laparoscopic cystectomy without, you know, rupturing the specimen with a teratoma? Because teratoma does have some solid components. Were they able to aspirate any fluid contents? You won't be able to aspirate everything because there are other components within the teratoma. So those will be some questions that I would ask the candidate. What are ultrasound findings suggestive of malignancy? So again, a size greater than 10 centimeters, papillary or solid components, an irregularity, present of ascites, and high color Doppler. And that's straight from the practice bulletin number 174 of evaluation and management of adnexal masses. Okay? Now, something I've seen in many case lists is when somebody does aspiration of a cyst, they still leave it in place, or they do it like literally what we call cystotomy, suction out the fluid. Is that the proper thing to do? Just for everybody on the call, I found it interesting. If you aspirate a simple cyst, recurrence rate at 6 months was 44% in the premenopausal patient and 25% in a menopausal patient. And that being said, I don't know if I would ever aspirate a cyst in a menopausal patient, even if a CA-125 was normal. Okay? Those are things that I would brought up for the candidate. I definitely, just because of the size of the mass, I would have done the tumor markers. So you're in this pickle, you did not do the tumor markers, and you're very concerned that the examiners will just ding you, and you're going to fail this that section just on this question alone. There is nothing wrong in saying during the exam, as I have been preparing for my oral boards, I realized this, that, and the other, and I have changed my practice because of what I realized of the new, you know, recommendations or whatever the case may be. There's nothing wrong with saying, yeah, I did it wrong before or not thorough enough before, and now I'm doing something different. That being said, if the candidate has access to GYN oncology 24/7, then is that an issue? No, I would call my oncologist so they can come and help me out and do any staging, and I've consented the patient in that regards of that possibility. I'm assuming she did not do that, seeing she didn't do the tumor markers. It's possible the tumor markers will not be elevated. I know more so for borderline tumors that are more epithelial or mucinous, they still get the tumor markers. Talking oncology, they still do tumor markers, but when you look at, let's say, up to date, tumor markers are not that beneficial in a borderline scenario. So it's possible in this scenario as well, with, let's say, you have borderline changes of a teratoma, you may not as well. But before taking anybody to the operating room, especially a 19-year-old that has a large mass, you have to worry the germ cell tumor. And you should do those tumor markers. Again, if you have access to GYN oncology, you could always call them in. If you live in an area, in an urban area, we have oncology on call at all times. So you're in a small town, it's a little bit more difficult. So I'm going to open up the floor to see if anybody has anything to add to that presentation. Please keep the background noise at a minimum. All right. Does anybody have any questions on that? Any questions? Made sense? All right. Does anybody have a question or a concern they'd like to discuss, because we have some more time?
I had a specific question.
Okay, let me ask you, can you tell me your area code, or if you want to tell me your name? Usually area code is better, and I can mute everybody else. Where are you at?
314.
314. I'm looking for it. There's a lot of people on the call, so bear with me. I'm going to mute everybody here. Give me a second. I'll go back to you. Are you there? Are you there?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. What's your question?
I have been reviewing shoulder dystocia and just, you know, taking it all the way to the extreme. And I had listened to some seminars and read some things that said, you know, your ultimate is a Zavinelli or like an abdominal rescue. And then I had read other things and like in my practice, like that clavicular fracture would be something you would do and then retry your maneuvers before you would like do Zavinelli. But then I was reading that's not the case. So I just didn't like if they give you a structured case and they want to take you to the end of it,
sure.
Like what order do you do those things in?
Sure. So this is what I would do, you know, not that I've ever done it on a person, thank God. Because, you know, at that point, you know, tension, you know, everybody's stressed out. So you start off with your McRoberts, your suprapubic, also with the suprapubic, what, you know, you kind of go always towards the face of the baby. You've heard that? So we do that a lot.
Yeah, in the axillary.
Exactly. So we always do a lot of drills.
Yeah.
Right, we always do a lot of drills where we tell the nurse, please push towards, you know, the door if the baby's face is towards the door. And it makes perfect sense. You're trying to push that down.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't work. You know, you're going to be getting your assistants. You know, they ring the bell, you know, with the hospitalist model. Immediately when a shoulder is encountered, you'll go straight to your posterior shoulder. Meanwhile, you always have to go back. When you do something new, you always go back to the other maneuvers. Repeat the maneuvers again. After the posterior
mm-hmm.
shoulder, you do your rotational maneuvers, the woods, as an example.
Yeah.
And I'm blanking right now on the name of the other one.
Rubens.
You do those. If that doesn't work, it depends who you read. Some people would break the clavicle at this point, but they're saying this is because I remember, you know, I've been doing this for 20 years. They would go to the clavicle before they would take anybody to the back as you're moving to the back.
Yeah,
but
which in residency, like I actually did and it worked and I mean, it sucked, but I mean, for me, it's a lot less morbid and dangerous than a Zavinelli.
Right, right. And for those on the call, you snap it out, not in, because you could cause damage
yeah.
to the
lung.
To the lung. But then if that doesn't work, go to the other side. And when that
mm-hmm.
happens, you repeat the maneuvers again. Now, what I have read, never done it, is you feel that she needs to go to the back. That's it. You've done everything. This kid's in there. You put her in Gaskin's maneuver. So that's in essence in hands and knees.
Mm-hmm.
As you're moving to the operating room, that way you're not wasting any time and you're on the bed with the patient. And in essence, you're trying to apply your gentle pressure, for lack of a better word, towards the ceiling. It's a midwife maneuver. Midwives have done it through the years, and apparently it's very effective. Never done it, but apparently just that process of moving the patient and all that is effective. And you're moving to the back, okay? And then hopefully you're doing something and not wasting those precious seconds as you're moving the patient towards the back. And then you take her to the operating room. It's very hard to do a Salmonelli, extremely hard. I know of one case. When I was in residency, they were able to do it, and the baby came out pretty decent. But I think they did things pretty quickly in that scenario because they thought there'd be no other. But we never did posterior shoulder the way we do it now and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So you could do the abdominal rescue. You could push from the top before you cut into the uterus. That might be beneficial. Another option is a symphysiotomy. Now, when I was a resident and during this exam, you did not bring this up. But apparently, people are bringing it up more often now. So how would you do the symphysiotomy, right? Any idea?
I mean, I wouldn't.
Yeah, I mean, but that's an option. So I actually, believe it or not, worked with somebody who did do it. So in essence, you supposedly put something inside the urethra, deviate it to the side, you get a scalpel and cut all the way up. And supposedly it opens up the patient's pelvis right away and the baby just slides out. So I know of a case where the baby got stuck. They couldn't do anything to get the baby out. They did the symphysiotomy. It was an almost 11-pound baby. And they just had to, like, you know, put a patient with a girdle and stuff like that. And she actually did pretty well. So I know it's felt that that's not really an option in an industrialized nation. But apparently it is part of the steps. I would leave that, as, you know, with the Zalmanelli myself. But, you know, if you have no other option, it's Zalmanelli or the symphysiotomy, you have a better success with the symphysiotomy. And I know.
And would they ever try to, like, get you, like, how would they incorporate episiotomy? And because, like, to say, oh, because I wouldn't routinely do that for a shoulder unless I thought that would really help that case.
It's interesting because we had a big case where I come from where the baby was down for like 9 minutes and the baby did not do well once they were able to get it out. And when they reviewed the case, they never did an episiotomy, and that was brought up as very questionable. But they said they had enough room. I don't know what that means.
Mm-hmm.
On the flip side, how difficult is it to do an episiotomy when you have a turtle sign? It's not going to be easy.
Difficult. Yeah.
It's not going to be easy at all. That being said, let's say you did a fourth degree laceration on purpose to try and get that baby out. Is that really going to help dislodge a bone to a bone?
No.
You know what I'm saying? It will help sticking your hand in there and doing the maneuvers.
Right.
So that's why
I don't routinely do it because
But a lot of people were dinging them because they didn't do the episiotomy. Part of me is like, how easy is it? You know, now, for example, if I had a patient who had a previous shoulder dystocia and she wants to try and deliver the baby natural, trying to do a vaginal delivery, not a problem. I would do an episiotomy on her automatically just in case she did get another shoulder dystocia. I have the space to do all the maneuvers. Am I making sense?
Yeah, I think if it's hindering your ability to perform the maneuvers adequately, you should do it.
Yeah, but it's still very, very hard.
Yeah.
It's not that easy when that head is really stuck in there and you're trying to put your hand. You know, and you always hear it's the person with the smallest hand that was able to dislodge it. You always hear that all the time. And, of course, and everybody's yelling, everybody's freaking out, of course. It's not easy.
Okay, that was just my question. Thank you.
Does that answer your question? So, I mean, if they push you, you push you. But I don't see anything wrong because I know somebody who's a simulator, and apparently clavicular fracture is considered there's a word that they use, and I'm blanking right now. I'm sorry to say, I'm just blanking. It's injurious. You know, it's an injurious procedure. But to me, it's not. But apparently, it is now. You know, because she did a deep dive on shoulder for one of her simulations. And, you know, because when I was a resident, we didn't do that much posterior arm. You literally did the Woods first and then the Rubens.
So if they were to ask me and I were to list that before Zavinelli, that would be appropriate, or you think I would
A clavicular fracture? I would. I mean, I would definitely break a clavicle before.
I would do it in real life, so.
I'm sorry, you're breaking up. Say again.
I said that's what I would do in real life as well. So.
You're breaking up. Say again.
Oh, sorry. I said that's what I would do in real life as well.
Oh, yeah. Okay, got it. Yeah. I have to agree with you there. Again, the Salmonella is very, 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 very hard. Very hard.
Thank you so much.
No, thank you for bringing it up. Thank you so much. I'm just going to open it up. If anybody has any questions, please keep the noise to. Does anybody have any questions? Anybody have any questions about anything that we discussed? Want to bring something up about the exam or anything before I let you guys go? No questions? All right. I don't see anybody chiming in because, unfortunately, there's no hand raised selection here, so I'm going to just mute everybody. I'm going to leave it out one more time. Any other questions? Okay, well, hopefully you found this productive. I'm going to mute everybody. That participated. Thank you for your topics. At this point, just want to let you know that the next teleseminar is on September 21st. Again, on September 21st is the next teleseminar. I want to thank everybody that participated. Thank you for the topics. Hopefully you found this beneficial. Wish you the best of luck in your continued studies. I know that coming up next month, because it's almost September 1st, it's going to be the first batch of exams. I wish everybody the best of luck in their studies. And again, the next teleseminar is on September 21st. I hope everybody has a good rest of the day and a good week. Thank you.